This interview with Alonzo Turner Bay was recorded on July 6, 2021, during the Baltimore Youth Film Arts Workshop, Inside Stories, Perspectives on Incarceration.
I got to learn to take care of myself more. I've been fighting the cause, and I got to do a little bit more self-care. Trying to help other juveniles get out of prison, trying to help other lifers and long-term offenders get out, change the narrative on criminal justice reform, because, Maryland is worse than Mississippi when it comes to juvenile serving life, when it comes to the parole board, parole system. Maryland allocates about $1.5, close to $2 billion a year to DOC. But to be truthful with y'all, a great portion of the money goes into overtime. Why? I don't know. But the programming is lacking. I was released last year, October the 16th. Everybody was talking about 4th of July. I said, my Independence Day is October the 16th. I was free. I was released out of prison approximately 12:45, 12:46. I walked out of prison gates after 31 years, 6 months and 15 days. Of a life sentence as a juvenile, a first-time offender. Man, all praise due to God. All praise is due to God, because if it wasn't for my belief in God, I'm going to tell you the truth, I wouldn't be here. I've known friends who was in prison as a youth, as a juvenile. I watched them give up and hang themselves, commit suicide. I've seen men OD. You know what I'm saying? I've seen things happen to men in prison, man, that the average person couldn't handle. You know, there are still things and traumas that I've witnessed and I've seen in prison that I have compartmentalized that I haven't even unpacked yet, you know. I'm going to tell you a story. I remember staying when I went to prison, and I went into the Maryland State Penitentiary in 1990. This was the maximum security prison throughout the whole state, one of the worst prisons on the East Coast, in the top 5. I can remember one night waking up, hearing somebody yell, holler, and they was wailing, banging. Then I heard other guys start making noise, and they turned their radios up real loud. I didn't know what was going on. So it was bothering me to scream. I come out the next day to find out that a young guy who was about my age was being raped by a cell buddy. I took all the little bit of money I had, went to commissary, bought 2 cottons of cigarettes. I purchased a knife. Because I refuse to allow that to happen to me. And then, you know, when I think back to it, for other men to make noise and to holler and to play their radio so that this man couldn't get no help, it hurt it more. Because in some way, when I look back on it, they was complicit. But then on top of that, the staff was complicit. Because ain't no way in the world a child supposed to be taken advantage of. You may have read about the crack era and stuff like that, especially in the Washington, D.C. era, in this era. Drugs was running rampant. I got involved with selling drugs. It wasn't something I had to, because both my parents worked fairly decent jobs. My father worked at the United States government printing office. My mother worked in the Hart Senate building. You know, I remember one time I got my learners, and me and my father was driving, and we were driving down Sheriff Road, and it was this pretty red convertible BMW. And I'm like, Dad, I like that. And he told me, he said, you graduate from school, I'll buy it for you. Now, remember, this is an era when drugs was plentiful. I didn't wait, man. I didn't wait. My impatience took me to a place, man, that I wish for no person or no juvenile ever to go. I started dibbling and dabbing in the drug game. You know, hanging out with guys that was much older than me. And I was selling crack. I was doing things that a juvenile, an adolescent shouldn't be doing. And I got caught up with a guy. He was 25. And I was selling drugs and things of that nature. And I got robbed by a guy and his friends. And it was a situation where they were setting me up to get robbed. The guy ended up coming back about 2 days later, and I ended up shooting him one time in the chest. I'm a co-defendant. He'd done 13 years. He was given 20. I was given life plus 5 years. I served 31 years, and he served 13. My father was hurt, and I'm going to tell you why. My father got three other brothers. It's all together, it's eight of them, four boys, four girls. My father never been to prison. Served in the military during Vietnam, got out of Vietnam, served in the reserve, honorably discharged. I went to school every day. I took a plumbing and heating. My brother and sister went to school. My father was proud that he didn't ever been in prison or any of his children. So when I went to prison, it was somewhat a shock, because out of all the grandchildren, I was one of the most smartest. I didn't get in trouble. I didn't engage in certain behaviors or activities. And my father, he would make us read books, do book reports and things like that. So it was a shock on the family when it happened. But my mother was there, my brother, sister there, my father was there. But during my incarceration, me and my father had a falling out, and it hurt me. My father passed away December 18th, 1999. And because of my stubbornness and his stubbornness, we didn't speak for the last few years of his life. And I carried that bird. But in carrying that bird, I try to make sure everything I do, I know that he's proud of. I am one of the only inmates that was while in prison, besides Walter Lomax, who was able to craft legislation while in prison. But when I got out, I seen it pass. The Juvenile Restoration Act is my baby. I wrote it by hand. Delegate Jazz Lewis, I sent it to him, Delegate Irk Byrne, and a few other delegates. Jazz Lewis accepted it, and the first year we didn't do well. I got out this year, and it passed. Any individual who caught their crime or crime was committed while under the age of 18 years old, after serving 20 years in prison, you are able to petition the court for modification of sentence on three different occasions. If you are denied the first occasion, you got to wait 3 years to go back. You denied the second occasion, you got to wait 3 years to go back. Any subsequent petitions after the third hearing are discretionary by the judge, but the first three, they are mandatory hearings, and there are certain factors that must be met when the judge is considering reducing your sentence. And I'm here to say I'm proud of the fact that I was had something to do with that. Let me say this. Because I went in as a juvenile, I work with an organization called Fresh, Fully Restoring Every Son's Hope. We work right now, if y'all go on my Facebook page, Alonzo Turner Bay on Facebook, we've been going around the country. We've been a few states, Chicago, South Carolina, here in Maryland, Virginia. We got to go back to Petersburg, Virginia. We've been a few different states. We teach young men and young women from the age of 10 all the way up to about 20 about their rights. So when they interact with law enforcement and interact in a manner where they can go home at night, our whole goal and objective is you to go home to your mother and father. Any other problems you have with the police, we can deal with later. But if something happened to you, you get shot, you die, you get beat, or anything like that, that little small issue is no longer of relevance. We got to deal with you then. So we teach them about their Fourth Amendment. We teach them about their Fifth Amendment. We teach them about their Sixth Amendment. The police walk up to you and ask you, can he see your cell phone? You can say, no, I respectfully decline and because of my Fourth Amendment of the United States Constitution, which means you are protected from unlawful search and seizure. He want to ask you questions. I invoke my Fifth Amendment. If you get arrested, you invoke all three, my Fourth, Fifth, and I invoke my Sixth, which means a right to counsel. If you don't have money, the government must provide you a lawyer. And a lot of our youth don't know that when they interact with law enforcement, that these are the three most significant rights that you have. So we go around teaching that to young men and women. And it's sad. We've been trying to get grants for this, and we've been doing it for, you know, a while. Everybody tell us, we love the work that you're doing, but and I understand what Baltimore going to. They're sending a lot of grant money to Baltimore. Mm-hmm. So for the last year since I've been home, we've been doing this out of our pocket. I'm glad you see that like that, Stan. and we had this one young guy in Upper Marlboro. After he learned it, he interacted with the police. We tell him, be respectful, be polite, because we don't know what kind of data law enforcement may have. You know what I'm saying? They people just like us. Yeah. They just put on a uniform. They can have a mm-hmm. bad day, and they end up taking it out on the wrong person. It's called misplaced aggression, you know? And I explain to youth that, look, they may have a bad day. Don't compound on it. So what you do, you talk to them respectfully. And he said he talked to the officer respectfully, invoked some of his rights, and the officer asked him where he learned it from him when he told him. And the officer told him, because you know what you're talking about, man, just go on about your day, man. Be careful. I'm not going to call him my friend. He's my co-defendant because of the things that he's done during our trial. I'm going to say this. He worked out a deal with the state. He got 20 years for first-degree felony murder and five other related charges. Many of y'all may not be familiar with the criminal justice system, but if anyone pleads guilty to first-degree felony murder is one of the most serious offenses on the book. At that time, it carried the death penalty or life without parole. So if you my co-defendant, you go with me somewhere in the transcript, proven, and it states clearly that my co-defendant told me to shoot the individual. Being I was a child, I was with somebody that's 25, I was following. It's called peer pressure. But I'm not going to say how much time he should have done or whatever. That's not my decision. And me personally, I don't want to see no one in prison, but I understand that there are some people, you know, they are removed from our community because they break the law. But I believe in second chances. You know, I truly believe in second chances because if God believes in second, if God give out second chances, I got to give out a second chance. I got to give out a second chance because God in the Bible gave out. He gave Saul, who later became Paul, a second chance. Just read Acts 9. If God can forgive him for being a serial killer and a mass murderer of Christians, I have to forgive. No, no. I could have made more money selling. I could have made all the drug money in the world. None of that money would be worth the 31 years I spent in prison. None of that money. I don't care how much money a person make. If a person tells you that it was worth it, man, you got to check that person because something might be wrong with them psychologically. I'm going to tell you this. The People for Ethical Treatment of Animals, PETA, if you were to put two dogs in that cell that they had me in, a 6x10, because I slept in a 6x10, and then when I first was incarcerated, it was a little smaller than that. If you put two dogs in there, PETA would be in front of the prison protesting, and they would make some type of changes in the law. But if you put two humans in there, it's okay. And imagine this, living in your bathroom with another person, with a tub at, put a bunk bed right there, and y'all got to do everything in that cell. I did 5 years on lockdown. Imagine being in there when somebody decided they want to use the bathroom. You got to smell it. That's where I lived for 31 years, in a 6x10 with another man. In the late 80s, early 90s, they built, if y'all go through Baltimore, it's 401 East Madison Street. It was called the Maryland Correctional Adjustment Center. That was the proper name. But to us inside of prison, it was called a Supermax. You locked down 24, 23, and 1. I can remember going 10 months without ever coming out my cell, except for a shower like 3 days out of a week. No outside rec, no nothing. So when you in a place like that, you got to find peace. But first, you got to find God. Because without a belief in God, man, I done seen men playing feces, go crazy, and in the process trying to drive other people crazy. So you got to find a way to entertain yourself. I read books. I can remember reading newspaper 2 and 3 months old. We used to have a saying, old news is good news if you never heard it. So I would read newspapers that's 2 and 3 months old. I would get a Washington Post and read the entire newspaper. And so sometimes I would be following news stories and articles, you know, making sure I get the paper because part two of it may be coming out in 2 more days. You know what I'm saying? I used to watch Stan on TV, and he's doing certain stories, and he'd tell you, they would leave you with a story and leave you with a cliffhanger where you got to come back tomorrow on 11 o'clock news to catch it. So you got to, you know, you certain stories you want to catch, certain things you want to do, you got to formulate your day in such a fashion where it's beneficial to you. I exercise 5 days a week. I'm talking about I get up in the morning, I do 500 push-ups, 500 jumping jacks, 500 toe touches, you know, different exercises, sit-ups, crunches. You know what I'm saying? You got to do things to make sure that this stays sharp. Because at any given moment, when you locked inside of that, and I used to call it the steel jacket, that steel jacket can turn into a straight jacket. And that's why I always tell people, you got to believe in God. To me, some of y'all may not understand it when I say it has to be a God somewhere, because I seen where I came from to where I am, and I'm still mentally fit. I'm still mentally sound. And I can hold an intelligent conversation with the best of them and not miss a beat. I went to college in prison all the way up until Bill Clinton took the Pell Grant. I went to Cotton State College. Then from Cotton State, I got some other college credits with American College through Hagerstown Community College and things like that. But I wasn't able to finish and get my degree, but education is important. If you got to educate yourself while you're in prison, because if not, man, some things going to happen to you in there, man, that you ain't ready for. I became politically active around about 2000, maybe a little more than that. I'm going to take you back a little bit. In September 1995, then governor, Democratic, Purvis Glendinning, he was down in the polls in the state of Maryland. He was going to lose the election. He came to Maryland Correctional Institution of Justice. At that time, it was called Annex. And he stood on a hill and he said, life means life. He made a life means life statement. Y'all can go look it up in the newspaper, Baltimore Sun. After he made that statement, he said, nobody who is serving a life sentence will ever be paroled, therefore violating Maryland law. In 1932, Maryland parole system said, if you're serving a life sentence, with parole, you'll be eligible for parole after 15 years, but the governor had to sign for it. He said he would not sign anybody parole papers under any circumstances. He told the parole board never to send any papers to him, even those who was terminally ill and dying, which is called compassionate release. That stayed in place all the way up until last year. Every governor backed that. Every Democratic governor and every Republican governor. With this, Early wanted to make a change to it, and he started putting some mechanisms in place. So I became a little more politically active in 2000 with the help of Walter Lomax. He served 40 years for a crime he did not commit. He founded an organization called Maryland Restorative Justice. And this brother educated me about the legislative process. He educated me about senators, about delegates, how to write them, get them, write them back. And I've been doing it every year. Just writing them, trying to push the lifers bill to remove the governor from the parole process. And then around about 14, between 12 and 14, the Supreme Court made some major rulings dealing with juveniles serving life and life without parole, what we call ELWOP. When I seen those issues, I say, man, even though the court technically sentenced me to life with parole, because of what the governors in the state of Maryland doing, I'm serving an ELWOP, life without parole. So we started to, you know, everybody would put their heads together. And a lot of people refer to me as a jailhouse lawyer because I learned the law in prison. And I would write people to have them come in. I got an organization that I started in prison, which I'm in the process of trying to make a nonprofit called Positive Change, which stands for Positive Citizens Helping a New Generation Evolve. Mm-hmm. So I was able to get Delegate Proctor come in, Jill Carter came in, Vanessa Atterbury came in, Delegate Irk Burns came in, Jimmy Tarlow came in. I had people coming in, and they liked what they heard about my organization and our conversation. And around about 18, when I seen Washington, D.C. pass their bill, which is called IRA, the Reduction of Incarcerated Act, and I went after that. After then, I just began to put my pen to the pad, and I was getting a lot of rough drafts, and guys who I knew the law in prison, I would pass it around and ask them what they think. I would bounce it off, you know, with my think tank men. And after I got me a nice, good, rough draft together, and I put all my pieces in puddle, I paid it. I don't type. I don't know how to type. Everything I did in prison, I did by our handwriting. And Stan to tell you, when you get a letter from a person who took their time and wrote it by hand, it means more than a letter that's been done by a computer, email, or typewriter, because that person put thought in it.
True.
And I wrote a lot of politicians. I sent this, I got it typed up. I sent it to every senator and every delegate. That means I sent out over 200 letters. Two people responded, Delegate Irk Burns out of PG County and Delegate Jazz Lewis out of PG County. Both of them is out of, I think, the 25th or the 26th district. And Irk Burns turned it into, which was, about 2 years ago, was called the Second Chance Act. Jazz Lewis submitted the bill word for word verbatim for past 2, maybe 3 years, and this year it passed. I just couldn't give up because I looked at myself and I looked at other men who were juveniles, other women who were juveniles, and they were serving these sentences. It's a packet of pictures of individuals who were serving life. And one whole page is about 30 juveniles. One of the persons on there is a guy named Gary Miller, I know. All of them. It's a three-page thing. One of the three is all juveniles. He'd been locked up since 1965. He went to prison at 16. He remembered when prison was segregated. He's still locked up today. He stopped going up for parole because for 11 years, the parole board promised him they would give him parole next year. They gave him 11 one-year set-offs. After a while, he stopped. He said, man, I'm not going up no more. He said, man, I gave up. I gave up hope. He's an older guy. He's a white guy. A friend of ours who got out, who was a juvenile named Nathaniel Foster, was able to convince him, man, go back up and see the parole board, man. We're going to support you. You know what I'm saying? Everybody, you know, wrote letters and stuff. His whole family is dead. This man been in prison since before Martin Luther King got killed. He was in prison when King was assassinated. So just think back how far that was. And he was a juvenile. Right now, he's incarcerated in Maryland Correctional Institute in Hagerstown. Let me say this. Everybody say Mississippi the worst state in the world, in the country. Maryland is behind Mississippi when it comes to criminal justice reform, when it comes to juvenile offenders serving life, when it comes to men and women of African descent incarceration. Maryland got close to 300 to 400, depending on how you count it, juveniles that are serving life or long-term sentences. Approximately 80% of them are people of African ancestry. Every 8 out of 10 look like me. And a lot of people may not understand this when I say it, but think about this. Every country has a natural resource, their most precious economy. America don't have a natural resource that come out the ground. So our best next thing is our children. This country cannot thrive without its youth. So how is it we the only country on the planet Earth, not even China, not even South Africa, or any other country, locks their youth up for the rest of their life? No other country on this planet locks their youth up for the rest of their life. Stan, think about what you did when you was 15, 16, between the ages of 13 and 21. All the stupid things you got, you ain't got to tell nobody. Would you have done those same things again at 35, at 40? We throw rocks at cars. I take and roll a tie down the middle of the street. I remember one time I was young, we would burn straws and throw them up in the air over top of one of them laying down, burn me on my head. That's not something a mature-minded individual would do. But because we're young, we follow peer pressure. We're impulsive. We don't think before we act. We just do a bunch of crazy stuff. When we start smelling ourselves, no. I'm going to tell you what makes it look like that. Social media. There's more cameras around now than this. But also, we got to remember this. A lot of crimes are crimes of economic, crimes of opportunity. We're putting a lot of money in the wrong places. One thing I honor and I respect about Marion Barry, when he started that summer youth program, he said between the ages of 14 and 21, if you want a job, I'm going to give it to you. And if we start doing that to our youth, if we start giving them something, making them feel appreciated, making them feel wanted, making them feel loved, and doing things to help them better their situation, sure, this scenario for all of y'all. I'm a drug dealer on the corner. I got two children. Well, I got one child. I'm taking this drug money to put food on the table, pampers on him, little roof over his head. But you tell me stop selling drugs. But if you give me something to take these drugs out of this hand and you put something in this hand, you got to replace that. You tell the person to stop selling drugs, to stop putting food on his son's table, stop putting pampers. But you have nothing to replace that with. If you get that person a job where they can see something sustainable, where they can work towards, everybody will lead a crime world. But when we don't do that, how can you expect the person to give up doing something for their family to doing nothing? No man who's worth his weight in salt want to be a burden on a woman or his family. During the time that they had Pell Grants in prison, Maryland was leading the nation in college graduate degrees. Maryland was getting ready to get inside of prison a master's degree program through Coppin State because men was educating themselves in prison. They was doing something with their time and they was bettering themselves. And they was taking that information and giving it to their family. So now people start complaining, oh, this person in prison going. But if you look at the numbers, not even 5% of the Pell Grant money was going to prison. The rest was going outside to people in the community, people in society. But because men in prison was graduating in large numbers, we wasn't getting the Pell Grant to just drop off. We was getting the Pell Grant and following it through and graduating. You know what I'm saying? Some guys was graduating with, they might go get an AA degree, then they go to BA degree. Some guys was getting two BS's degrees because that's how many classes they was taking. And that's how studious they was about learning. So, you know, when they took it away, man, they took away a lot of hope. You know what I'm saying? They took away a lot of inspiration. You know, these youths that's coming in prison now, and you can fact check this, DOC has a policy in place where they are only required by law, if you're age 21 and under, to give you 180 days worth of school time. After you get that 180 days, they can put you out. Think about that. Hmm. I come to prison at 17. By law, they're only required to give me 180 days of school. And with something I've been noticing when I was in Justice Correctional Institution, they had a principal named Ms. Banks. She was putting guys out of school because she's saying they wasn't following the classwork fast enough. They wasn't learning fast enough. They wasn't progressing fast enough. Well, If I got lead paint, my mother was on crack. My father may have been on crack. My mother may have been on heroin. She may have been an alcoholic. When I got all these issues, how do you expect me to progress at the same rate of an individual who parents who may have not gotten high, who may have not have these learning disabilities? And so in turn, that's one of the reasons they put people out, the education in Maryland. They say you are not progressing fast enough. When they canceled the Pell Grant, it was because people in society was complaining that my daughter can't go to college, but these inmates going to college and getting degrees. But your son and daughter really didn't. And let me say this. A lot of people who say they want to go to college, there are so many grants out there, so many, that every year they go wasted. Money go back to the government. It's just people don't look for them and apply themselves. And in turn, guys in prison was because we didn't have nothing else but time to read, time to study. But there's a lot of grants out there. Even if y'all go online and look up the grants that you can get in college, people will just, as long as you're getting good grades, people will give you a grant to help pay your food. You know what I'm saying? Give you a stipend for your food. They might give you $100 a month. That's $100 less. That's $100 more than what you had and $100 less of your parents' money you have to spend. All you got to do is take some time and go on a computer and look for them. But people was complaining that we was getting degrees and that their children couldn't. And so Bill Clinton got rid of them. The same thing, and some people get mad when I bring this up, especially people who support the Democratic Party heavily. The same thing him and Hillary done with the 1995-96 crime bill, which incarcerated us at so much of a fast number that right now we're still trying to undo that, and we can't. Prison, and this may seem strange, but I just, is like a small community, it's like a smaller community inside of a community. All right, you go to prison, there's a good chance one of your homeboys or somebody you know, or somebody that knows somebody you know, is in prison. In a county jail, they had me in a unit with adults and stuff and with some juveniles. But when I went into the system, a lot of people try to figure out where you're from. I was born and raised on Bennett Road in Southeast D.C. So when people asked me where I was from, you know, I would tell them, and they would say, man, that's your homeboy over there. They would point to an older person. Man, that's your homeboy, whatever. You know, and standard change inside of Maryland State Penitentiary, at one time they had a D.C. Baltimore a rivalry. Where it came from, I don't know. But over the years, it died down. But a lot of guys from out of Washington were hanging with each other, a lot of guys out of Baltimore. But over the years, it changed. And they would tell you, they would teach you what things to do and what not to do. And plus, I had uncles who'd been locked up, and they told me, man, look, don't take nothing from nobody. Don't eat no food from nobody. Don't take no Debbies. Don't smoke no cigarettes. So, you know, I didn't smoke, drink, get high, none of that. So they would tell you, you know, what to do and what not to do. And some of these rules and advice, man, you got to hang on to them. If you was hungry, you go in the kitchen and eat as much as you can while you're there. So later on at night, you know, you drink about 2 big cups of water. You lay down, make yourself full. But I'm going to say this, and some people didn't agree when I said it. COVID was a blessing to me. COVID was a blessing to me because the world and the state and the towns and places wasn't going on a normal speed. So things were slowed down. They was locked down when I got out. Remember, I got out October last year. So things were slowed down. But it was slow to y'all, but it was fast to me. So I was trying to play catch up. I'm trying to catch up what's going on. And things is going so fast, but everybody like, man, we're on lockdown. But I already know what lockdown like. There's people out here complaining because they can't do this and that. So, man, y'all ain't been locked down. You want to know what lockdown is? Go and you'll lock yourself in your bathroom and stay in there for the next month. And I'm gonna open the door, slide you your food. Let you out for 1 hour. That's lockdown. So a lot of people was having a problem with this COVID adjusting. You know, marriages breaking up. People been married 20, 30 years. They breaking up because now they got to get to know each other. They got to get to know themselves. But to me, I know myself. I done been in the cell with myself. You know what I'm saying? I can live in a house locked down with other people. You know what I'm saying? But a lot of people couldn't. So I already adjusted to the lockdown part. I remember I came out on the 16th. On the 20th, I had my learners. I went to the DMV with my release papers. It was two sisters sitting there. One was right here, then another one's over there. I went to her. I said, excuse me for a minute, miss. I waited everybody get out of my way because I didn't want them in my business. I say, listen, I just come home. I did 31 years, 6 months, and 15 days. I went to prison when I was 17. I say, they told me if I bring my release papers here, I can get my ID. I say, I need your help. And remember, this COVID, everything is done by appointment. But I'm gonna show you how you can work things. I use my story. I got in the DMV. She said, baby, look, I'm letting you in. She let me in. And, man, every time I see her, I thank her. Then the security guard, she told her, look, write his name down. I got these shirts. I'm going to pull one of them out. And it say, Free Alonzo Turner Bay. I had that shirt on when I went into the DMV. The security guard girl looked at the shirt. She said, that's you? I said, yeah, I just come home after 31 years. I asked, I whispered to her. I said, can I take my learners while I'm in here? She said, yeah, baby. She said, look, go around there, make a right. It's going to be a woman at the desk with dreadlocks. Go to her. I went to her. I told her my story. She said, you got $50? I said, yeah. She said, why are you getting your ID? Tell them you want to take your learners. I went around there, took my learners and passed. See, I've been reading the driver's manual for the last year of my incarceration because I had it here that I was coming home. And so when I got my learners, they didn't give you the ID then. They gave me a piece of paper, and they said, your learners be in the mail. And I walked out. I knew then, man, it wasn't nothing else going to stop me. Pure determination. Everything I wanted, I'd say I was going to have. And, man, a lot of people would get mad. They told me, stop telling people you was locked up. Say, man, that's my story. That's part of my life. And people would, they were like, man, you telling people you was locked up? And guess what? My story helped get other doors open for me. Helped me find people that can help me. Help me move through certain places. Because that's my story. That's my reality. I've been gone 31 years, 6 months, 15 days. There's a lot of things I didn't know and I would tell people. They're like, you don't know what I said? I say, miss, look, I just come home after 31 years. I went to prison at 17. They're like, oh, my God, baby, come here. This is what you do. No. They would go to people, no, leave. I got him. I'm gonna make sure he get what he supposed to get. And I try to tell people, you got to know when to use your story and when not to use your story. One thing prison teaches you, how to read the environment. Because in prison, if you ain't reading the environment right, you can die. The tension in the air in prison dictate if you go outside your cell or not. If I come out my cell and I look around and the tension is thick and I don't know what's going on, I'm locked back in. I was in prison the day that the officer lost his life. I remember Officer David McGuinn was killed. But I'm going to draw your attention before that. 1 year before he was killed, April the 1st, 2005, I saved the life of a female correction officer. It was a guy in prison who has a reputation for assaulting females. It was the one correction officer, she weighed about 100 pounds soaking wet. He tried to rape her. I intervened, saved her life and a nurse's life because he tried to grab a nurse. 1 year fast forward, the administration took no steps into curbing the violence in the institution. Officer David McGuinn had been receiving death threats. They'd be getting notes on him and things like that. And the night he was killed, man, that was a horrible night. You could feel the tension in the air. It was kind of thick. And I knew something would happen because I worked in an infirmary on the midnight shift in the institution prison hospital. They usually hit my door for work around about 10, between 10 and 10:15. When my door did not get hit and I heard the helicopter land, I knew something horrible had happened. And I turned on the news, and I seen that an officer had been murdered. I knew the officer, me and him spoke on many occasions. They called him Homeland Security. He was one of those officers who liked to go way and beyond his job. He would, you know, write his coworkers up, always trying to shake down and find contraband and do things. And one day I was asking him, you know, he came from New Jersey. He had mentored youth. He had worked with different youth organizations and stuff. And I asked him, I say, man, why do you do what you do? He said, man, I want to make prisoners safe. And I had to explain to him, I say, man, you can't do it by yourself. If your warden and higher ups is not on the same page as you, things ain't going to work out. But before he had got killed, like, a couple of days before then, maybe a week or so before then, two correction officers were stabbed on that same tier. One correction officer left another correction officer. One correction officer was getting stabbed. Another correction officer came and ran to his aid, and he left that correction officer. DOC almost did not pay the correction officer who came to the other officer's assistance. No, they weren't trying to do nothing for the guy. But here's the ironic part. They couldn't find the knife or whatever the weapon involved. So it took them about a day or two, and they found it behind the cell. It fell all the way down. They blocked it off because they wanted the state police to come in and get the weapon. You know, one of the correction officers removed that weapon because they jumped on an inmate doing transfer. About six correction officers, they beat the inmate almost to death. Guess what they said the inmate done? They say he had a weapon, was trying to stab him. Lo and behold, they didn't know that they had already taken pictures of that weapon and it had blood on it. It was the weapon that killed Officer McGuinn. So they had tried to plant the murder weapon on another inmate. And when the state police came, they said, hold. No, this is the weapon that killed Officer McGuinn. How did it leave the crime scene and get down to the chapel where y'all assaulted the inmate? They beat this man up so bad his face looked like. Y'all remember that episode where Martin Lawrence was fighting Tommy Hearns?
Yes.
And I'm showing you just some of the corruption that's going on. And so you can see how officers are getting injured. And always, they always say the inmates, these guys, they in for some of the most heinous crimes. But see, they don't tell you the backstory about how some of these things be happening. All they know is a prisoner stabbed a guard or a prisoner beat a guard up or something like that. They don't tell you that. It's like if you put an animal in a cage and you keep poking them, you keep poking them, keep poking them, keep poking them, what do you expect the animal to do? Jump out and to protect itself because of its anger or to act out of anger. And these are some of the things that happens in DOC. But they don't tell you about it because they want us to be the savages. Why they are the humans or the ones always the victims, when in always cases it's not like that. I went to prison in April the 1st, 1989, April Fool's Day. That's why I don't play no jokes on April Fool's Day. I'm not going to say my transformation. In 2000, I became more politically active. But I knew. While I was in prison, I educated myself. I went to school. I did things like that. But in 2005, when I saved that correction officer's life, I still to this day got the notarized letter that she sent to that she wrote on my behalf saying how I saved her life. I still got that. When I saved that woman's life, I sat in my cell and I cried for about 2-3 days. And I asked myself, say, man, how did you put yourself in this position where you put your life online for a correction officer? And if that was my aha moment, that I'm not the same person I was when I came to prison. I knew then that I was a changed person. I knew then that I was a new. When I stepped in, and I didn't see her as a correction officer. I didn't see her as a nurse. I seen them as women. Children of God, and that somebody was going to be taken advantage of. I got a lot of women in my family. So I knew then that I was not the same person when I say that correction officer life. Like a day or two later, and one of the female officers, she had heard about it, and she was like, Lonzo, she like Turner Bay, because everybody referred to me by Turner Bay. You was a blessing. I had male officers would just walk up to me and say, thank you. I'd be like, man, what's going on? What you talking about? They say, man, thank you. And I had this one officer, he thanked me every day for a month. He would just always say, thank you, man. And then one day I asked him about it, and he told me. He said, man, you ain't had to save her. He said, man, she was a police, but you didn't see her as a police. You seen her as a woman, and you saved her life. He said, thank you, man, because that's what she was. Correctional officer is only an occupation. Being a woman, a child of God, is who you are. I'm only a convicted murderer because of the act that I commit, but I am a child of God by nature. It's only when we act in line with the things that God put in us that, man, things change. And that's why I work with our youth. Because I know who they can be. I know what they can do. All they need is somebody to hug them and love them. And I used to do that to the young guys in prison. They'd be talking trash to me and, oh, man, I don't want to hear that. I walk up to them and grab them and give them a hug. I say, this is what you need, a hug. Your father ain't hug you, so I'm going to be your father today. I'm going to hug you. They'd be like, man, get off me. But they'd be laughing. I can feel them laughing, and I can feel it when I hug them. Because a lot of them ain't never been hugged before. I've been hugged by my father, by my grandfather, by my great-grandfather. So I know what it feels like to be hugged by a man who genuinely cares about you. I want to incorporate the organization I found while in prison called Positive Change, which stands for Positive Citizens Helping. The word change stands for Citizens Helping a New Generation Evolve. So Positive Citizen, you know, to work with the youth. You know, that's what I want to do. You know what I'm saying? Because we need individuals to engage our youth. If we talk about changing what's going on out there, we got to become involved with our youth. Before I came on, I got a call from a young guy who went to prison at 15. He done 10 years. He home. When he came home, I took him out to the wharf. He wanted some shrimp. So I took him and got him some shrimp and stuff. But now he called me because he needed a job. So I told him, give me a couple of days. I'm going to make some calls and try to help him get some type of employment. See what I'm saying? Our youth want to do right. They want to do good. They want to live up to be the best of their potential. But, man, we can't keep throwing them away. And that's what I want to do. I want to work with the youth. You know what I'm saying? I know it's not paying much, but it's not always about money. You know what I'm saying? You know, you can have all the money in the world and not be happy. You ain't got to have no money and be happy. You got to know how to utilize the resources that are at your hand and that are available to you. And that's what I want to do to help these youth. Because I'm tired of seeing our youth go to waste. I want to see, I know they can do better. I know they can because I know what I could have done. And all we got to do is work with them. And I really appreciate y'all taking the time and hearing my story. And
one day. And I told him that a group of us would like to start a program in the course while we're here to talk to the first time youth offenders that's coming here. Because, like I said, I was nervous, I was scared. People was tricking you when you went in there. People was raping you and molesting you and things of that nature. And this stuff was still going on. And I explained that to the warden that, these guys coming here with nothing, and they asked to bar things, not understanding, the rules and regulations of this different world, of being in a different world other than being outside in another world, and a lot of times they would fall in the trap. So they allow us to start, this Youth Act program that while we was in there. I started a new job. Once I got out of that, I went into this other job called MCI program. It's like where you make the most money in the program, but we was printing up license stickers, yearly stickers and stuff like that to go on to cars and stuff like that for motor vehicle, they didn't contracts. So we was doing that. And I learned to do that. One of the things I learned is how to run a printing press. It's called an ABJ printing press and stuff like that. So I learned to do that with that. You have to choose and decide what you want to do with your time. You have to sit back and ask yourself, do you want to further go down the rabbit hole, or do you want to change, your way of life, And it's real hard to do that because I say, like, you're in a different world and there's so much going on around you and your mentality change, while you're there, So I made the choice, to try to say, I'm going to do something with my life because I don't even know if I'm going to make it home or not with a 50-year sentence. It's like having a life debt. It makes you feel good. It's more than making you feel good because first, let me get back to this. And I don't want to be redundant. I'm Muslim, and it gives you a different perspective on how to look at life, and how to look at another human being, whether you Muslim, Jew, Christian, whatever, atheist, whatever. It gives you a different perspective to look at life and how to respect it, So what you say, you have to be that. You couldn't just say something to somebody in there and not allow it to be your character. So it made me feel good that the things that I was saying to the guys that was coming in, that some of them was older than me, some of them wasn't older than me. It made me feel good to say the things that I was saying to them because I had to be what I was saying. My model had to be that inside of the jail. When we stepped out of this room and going back into, the jail system, you have to be that. And them guys looked at you real close, and they draw closer to you because they felt a sense of protection that everybody looked for when you go in there. Even the strongest guys, like when I talk about Little Melvin, Sim Charles, Stakem and stuff like that, even the guy from The Wire, they're my closest friends, Chris Warren and all of them, Bodie, all of them, they're my closest friends. These are guys I come up with. Even us, we cry. We feel a sense of abandonment. We feel like, we left alone and there's nobody there for us. So you have to, pull yourself together and you have to make a serious decision. Now, I didn't make this decision when I first went in there. I still had a street mentality. It was kill or be killed. Do what you had to do. You have to be there first, to find out, how do I deal with this world in here? How do I deal with all these ills that I heard about what's going on in here? You know what I mean? And again, I've seen guys trick dudes out of their butt. I seen dudes trick, and some of them was the best of friends. I heard a dude, and he was talking about paying off his bill. He said he had another court to go through, and he had already had a 30-year sentence. It was a white guy, and he said he don't think he can handle another, some more time. And it was a commissary day, and everybody was going up to the child when he was coming back from commissary. He said, I'm going to pay all y'all off that I owe y'all. He said, y'all can take this right here. He said, the rest of y'all, when y'all come back, it'll be in my cell. Now, his cell was next door to me. And again, I worked in an MCI shop. So that's the best job you can get in the system. I came down to go to commissary just to put my stuff in my cell and then go back to work. So I didn't go to child that day. So I heard something, and I had made my salat because my prayer came in. But I heard something kicking on the wall real hard, kicking on the wall real, real hard and stuff. I knocked on the wall, right? And I said, boy, you all right over there? And it wouldn't, never said nothing. So when they came back from child, he had hung himself. He had hung himself. You open up all the doors when you come back from child, but you got to get in your cell. And I stepped out there to look at him and make sure he was all right. But he had hung himself, you know. And it messed me up real bad, you know, because that wasn't the first hanging I saw. But he was actually a good dude, you know. I mean, we made mistakes, stuff like that, you know. But he was actually a good dude. You know, that wasn't the only hanging I saw. I saw a lot. You know, being in prison for 30 years, you see a lot. I'm going to give you two, and I'm going to try to make it as brief as possible. I'm gonna give you two of the experiences that I saw. Well, I'm gonna give you three, and I'm gonna make them real brief. Young guy, younger than me at the time, I had grown a little older then. I probably was in my mid-20s, maybe late-20s. Was on the phone talking to his young lady, telling her that, you know, don't leave, hold on. You know, I got a kid, but you say I'm going back to court. He said. And the judge talking about taking most of my time back. That means I would only have to do a year. You can hear him because he's talking real loud. And at this time, they had put phones on the tears. And he was talking real loud and stuff like that. And he was like, don't leave me. And started crying and stuff like that. And the officer, you know, told him he had to hold it down because he was loud and talking to his girl. So she must have hung up on him because he kept saying, you dead. And he tried to call back, and she wouldn't accept the call. He asked the officer to let him lock in and stuff. And he went and locked in. And about a half an hour, maybe to an hour later, you know, the tier he was on was a traffic tier. And what that means, you had to come through his tier to get to other tiers, you know. And one of his friends was coming up this through the tier to go to his cell. I mean, to go to his tier, looked in his cell, and he had hung himself. He was hanging from the bars, and when the officer opened up the grill, everybody ran down to his cell, you know, and they were telling the officer, open the door so we can grab and try to put him up to see if he was still living. Mm-hmm. But the officer, you can't do that. You got to leave the scene exactly the way it is, you yeah. know. And the officer wouldn't open the door. He wouldn't even go in there and do it until the warden came up and nurses from the infirmary came up. So we felt that sense of betrayal, you know, knowing that the system didn't have our best interests at heart. When gangs started getting popular in the jail, this guy, he, you know, his family was real supportive of him. So, and we get packages. We had package months and all that type of stuff. You know, and this guy, he would take certain guys and say, go, let me get a package in your name that wasn't getting packaged. He said, I'll get my mother to buy you a couple pair of jeans and I'll get my mother to buy you some tennis, you know, because he wanted to get it, you know, have a lot of clothes. Mm-hmm. So this particular dude, I knew the dude too, come out of Lexington Terrace. You know, he was in the game, Black Gorilla, whatever they call him. What's the name?
Family.
Exactly.
BFG, Black Gorilla right. Family.
That's right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And they went to him to lean on him and tell him to go get us some of this. And he told me, he said, man, you must be crazy. I'm not getting you anything. He said, all right. So I'm not, you know, scared of that. So we went in the yard that evening. And in jail, you can tell when something can happen because you feel that all around you, so you know it. You know, you feel that vibe going around you, and everybody back is to the wall. You know, so I walk out in the yard, and one of the guys say, you know, I used to like to run the yard. He used to say, Basim, hold on, man. He said, something great happened. And lo and behold, while I can turn around, you can hear a bat cracking. The dude hit the dude with the bat in the head and cracked his skull. Mm-hmm. He died. He died. They sent in an ambulance to lift him up out of there, but the guy died. We had to go in this place called the Annex, so they moved a lot of us off the tier because off of certain tiers because asbestos was all through the tier, and the fungus and stuff was going up the wall. So while they was working on it and closed down the tier, they sent us in this place called the Annex. It's like a dorm. Mm-hmm. You got three parts to this dorm. You know, so we had one tier in this dorm, one tier in that dorm, one tier. And you can interact with each other and stuff like that. This guy that I know that come out of Murphy Holmes, and another guy that came out of another part of Murphy Holmes, was there. And the older guy, and the guy was real small. He was leaning on the younger guy. He was always take his commissary, always go through his packets and stuff like that. And the younger guy would always report to the officers what the guy was doing. And he wanted to be moved from the tier or moved out of jail. And they would just discount it and throw it away and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So when they moved us down in the annex, and they had a gym period, and a guy told him, and it was a commissary day, and he told me, he said, when I come back, excuse my language, he said, my commissary shit better be on my bed. The young guy said, I'm tired of this, man. I'm not going to allow you to do this to me anymore. This is the last time. I'm not doing this. I'm not doing it. So on the way, when they came back from gym, we get like an hour and maybe 20 minutes to a half an hour in gym. You know, when he came back from gym, he come in there, he called himself being bad. He walked straight to the young guy. And the young guy pulled out an ice pick and stuck him right in his chest. And he left it in his chest. And the dude grabbed his chest and turned around. And what you call, what we got, where officers sit up in the station, we call it the bubble. He tried to walk to the bubble, and before he got to the bubble, he fell. And that's where he died. You know, so... You know, a lot of stuff in prison, yeah, you see. It's like a lot of yes, infection. And you have to you have to mold your life around that because you don't never know when it's going to be someone to challenge you. One thing my mother told me when she put me out, right, she used to always, you know, still be there for me, but she told me, don't you ever think you bad because of someone badder than you. And they will always challenge you. Because they want to be the most bad one. She said, but always be serious and a man of your word. And I stuck with that. It stuck with me to the day. I'm a serious brother. And I take things real serious. And I try to be a man of my word. And if things change, I go to the person and say, look, I have to do something else. This is what happened. Now, can you bear with me? Or let's just, you know, resolve the issue. You know, and I remember that, and it makes me a better man. Having a strike against you, you know, it always fall in a place where opportunities are lacking, and you are not, you know, given the best of the choices that come a person's way. But you have to realize that you put yourself in this position, and you have to make something happen for yourself. You know, society, to me, in a lot of ways, haven't gotten better. It got some ways worse than it was when I went in society because, you know, you did, like, you know, Brother Greg said, you had a moral compass out here on the streets when I went in. You know, men would be men, and they would stick, you know, they lived it by principles and standards and stuff like that. You know, today... Youth doesn't live by certain standards or morals and stuff like that. Even when you go into going into a company or a corporation and trying to get a job, you know, when I first came home, I went to this welding company, and my credentials was better than the guy that was before me and after me. And when I went into an interview, she asked me, was I ever incarcerated. I started to lie because I know is a window that you have from 5 to 7 years that they can ask you about your incarceration or put on your application. And I didn't put it on there. And when she went down the application, she asked me, you know, was you ever incarcerated? And I paused. And I was asking myself in my mind, you know, should I tell her the truth or should I lie? You know, and I said, I'm going to tell her the truth because this would be the best way of me getting something, you know, with my belief in God and everything and stuff like that. So I told her, I said, yes, I was incarcerated before. I said, but it'd been a long time ago. It was a while ago. I said, it was back in 1985. I said, I haven't been to prison since then. And then she said, would you mind expounding on what you was incarcerated for? And it kind of, I kind of knew then, right then and there, that I was going to be scratched from this list, right? And I told her, I said, is that a requirement? Do I have to do it? She said, no, you don't have to do it. She said, but I prefer you do it. Okay. I told her, I said, okay, well, I was young. I said, I come out of a drug-ridden area. Some of us would call it probably ghetto and things of that nature. I say, but it was, an area where you grew up and you had to make certain choices. I said, when I was young, I made the wrong choice. I said, I got in a situation where some guys kind of tried to rob me, and I had a gun on me. And I shot one of the guys, and he died. And she said, all right, I don't need to hear no more. But I knew right then and there that society wasn't going to play fair with me, you know, and that I would have to make my own way. But I had to understand, too, on the other side of that coin, no one did this to me but me, you know. So I had to find somewhere to keep trying to put this bitterness that I had with society about me being in incarceration in a place where it wouldn't affect me of doing what I needed to be done, you know. So, yeah, no. I think society plays for me. And sometimes it does. Yes, I appreciate that. I appreciate that, Anna. And you know, it was a blessing to me. You know, and just to piggyback from what you said, right, in terms of strength, a lot of people say to me, right, Fasim, that's my Muslim man. They say, Fasim, tell me the truth. You did 30 years straight. I say, yeah. I say, man, you're not demented. You're not crazy. Nothing like that stuff. I said, I'm blessed by God. I say, so if you call that crazy, then I'm crazy. I said, but no, I'm not crazy. Do I have my moments of psychological effects? I said, yeah, I had them. I said, but everybody has them. You know, I said, but I'm not crazy. I trusted God while I was there, and God brought me through. But when I went to prison, you know, I had a prison experience where I went to a Christian meeting and they was talking about other religious groups on how, you know, if you don't accept Christ, you're going to hell, and you and they this and they that, you know, some of them are nationalists and all. Now I said to them, this is before I caught my 50-year sentence. I say, why are we talking about other groups? Let's talk about what God can do for us. Because I'm scared, because I went in there, my papers, they give you a true bill when you have a murder. Had first degree on there, murder. You don't get the rest of the degrees until you go into court. You know, like first degree, second degree, manslaughter, something like that, or not guilty. You know, so I said, why do we keep talking about these people? Let's talk about what God going to do for us and what we need to do to change. I don't want to hear that in the outside coordinating them. And I hear the group say, well, if you don't want to hear this, you can leave, right? And I left. And I had already knew two older guys that was in Islam. Asked me, well, I thought you was at your meeting. I said, nah, I just went through something, you know, stuff like that. So they said, well, you're welcome to come to a Talim service, which is a speaking gathering when you go to the Muslim thing. And it made me open my heart to look at other religions. And I seen Islam, I found Islam was the best thing for me. You know, it opened my mind. You know, it gave me a different perspective about people and the world, you know. And it just went from there, you know, just went from there. But I try not to push it on other people, because they are who they are, regardless of what it is. You know, I just, you know, leave it to me. And when somebody asks me, then I explain it to them. I would love to do this again whenever you need me. I would love to give back because there's so much to what I have to say in terms of me that transitioned from being my first incarceration into my second. You know, and yes. the things that affected me in terms of my second incarceration. So I would love to do this again because I feel like I'm giving back.